Offline is brought to you by ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol. I have to tell you about this game-changing product I use before a night out with drinks that I've told you about a million times. It's called Pre-Alcohol. It's great. It actually works. You take a drink of pre-alcohol before you have some alcohol and you feel much better the next day. ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. It was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's a buildup of this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for rough days after drinking. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. Just remember to make pre-alcohol your first drink of the night. Drink responsibly, and you'll feel your best tomorrow. This works. ZBiotics works. You've heard us talk about ZBiotics before. Every single person we recommend it to after they drink ZBiotics before having a few drinks, they always feel better the next day. They're like, guys, you were right. Can't believe it. I'm like, yeah, of course we're right. Go to ZBiotics.com/offline to learn more and get 15% off your first order when you use offline at checkout. ZBiotics is back with 100% money back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. No questions asked. Remember to head to ZBiotics.com/offline and use the code offline at checkout for 15% off.
So like one day you will see Laura Loomer and a bunch of others talking about why some random legislation is important to the government of India. And you're like, that is 100% paid. And people have slowly been publishing investigations and receipts of this. I think in one instance, I saw a bunch of right-wing influencers were paid $50 just to hit the retweet button on a post. Others were being paid $1,000 just to copy and paste certain posts. And this is all in hopes of getting in front of Republican elected officials who are all addicted to using the app personally, and they know that they can get their stuff in front of the big guy in the White House as well. So I think X is just like a really, really important platform for them.
I'm Jon Favreau, and you just heard from today's guest, Kyle Tharp. Kyle writes an excellent newsletter about all the ways the internet is upending our politics, appropriately named Chaotic Era. He covers everything from the partisan media ecosystem to new digital campaign tactics to creators on the left and right who are suddenly having a huge political impact. For anyone trying to figure out how the hell people are getting their information these days, it is an essential read. Today, I invited Kyle on to talk about the many trends he's written about, but also to zero in on a couple that I believe may have an outsized impact on the 2026 midterms, namely the emergence of pay-for-play political influencers and whether Democrats have made any progress in figuring out the internet. We also covered the fall of Ben Shapiro in the Daily Wire, the new success of legacy media on TikTok, and the intense grassroots anger, online and off, around data centers. It was a great conversation, and we'll get to it in a moment. But before we do, if you want to hear this episode ad-free, subscribe to Friends of the Pod. Subscribers get ad-free episodes of Offline, Pod Save the World, Love It or Leave It, and Pod Save America, as well as special behind-the-paywall episodes like Dan Pfeiffer's Polar Coaster, Terminally Online, and an extra bi-weekly episode of Pod Save America called Pod Save America Only Friends. Of course, if you don't care about ad-free episodes, you could always subscribe to support independent pro-democracy media, one of the last outlets left out there that's independent and pro-democracy. So head on over to crooked.com/friends to subscribe. All right, here's Kyle Tharp. Kyle, welcome to Offline.
Thanks for having me on. We have a lot to discuss.
We do. So you've been covering the intersection of politics and the internet for years. You were first tracking digital ad spending in a newsletter for Courier News. And now you're at Chaotic Era, a Substack you launched right as Trump's second term began. Just to start with a big picture question, when you compare the internet's role in politics today to when you started, what is the single biggest change? Like what would surprise the 2018 version of yourself?
I mean, I think that's a really great question. I think the biggest thing is people are paying a lot more attention to it. I feel like back in 2018, there was like little bits of attention paid to, you know, ads on Facebook or whatever. But now it seems like the mainstream political press and generally voters are much more in tune with how they're being reached online and all the various forces that are influencing them. Now, I think also things are moving a whole lot faster, just like technology is accelerating. And so campaigns are and outside groups and other influence operations are just like reaching voters at a much faster pace online.
Do you think it's too simplistic to say that we've moved from the ad era to the creator era? I obviously know that ads are a big part of the spending, but it does feel like the creators are at least in tight competition with ads.
Yeah, absolutely. Like what types of paid media that campaigns are deploying to reach voters has changed dramatically since 2020, since 2016, since 2012. You know, it used to be really cable, broadcast, radio, mail. And now not only are people spending tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars on digital advertising on places like Facebook, but they're integrating sort of paid creator marketing campaigns into their media mix in a way that is now spreading down ballot. You saw a bunch of it during the California gubernatorial primary. There's like every week there's stories about how campaigns are paying off creators in sort of under the table or undisclosed fashion that we can talk more about. But absolutely, I mean, I think so much attention is now being paid to these niche social media influencers, both small and large, that are reaching voters on behalf of candidates, whether they're paid or not, whether campaigns are doing interviews with them or content collabs. It's really taking over our politics. And I think in the midterms, we're going to see a lot more of it. And then heading into 2028, it's going to be insane.
So I do want to get back to that. I just want to, before we get there, after 2024, the interminable discourse about Democrats needing a liberal version of Joe Rogan, it was basically a shorthand for a debate about all the ways that the Harris campaign and the Democratic Party failed to adapt to the new media environment. Now that we all have the benefit of like a year and a half of hindsight, what do you think that discourse got right and what did it get wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I think that discourse was really helpful in getting sort of Democrats' older donor class interested in the ways that the internet is impacting our politics and the different ways that Americans are consuming information. So a lot of the folks that fund major outside groups and efforts on the left, you know, get their news from like paper newspapers and probably like, I don't know,
cable,
network or broadcast television. And so I think it was really a wake up call for that class of folks that has a lot of influence in the Democratic Party that, oh, there are 1,000 different ways that 1,000 different niche subgroups of Americans are receiving information online. And we need to be more strategic about how we're investing in those ways. There have been like a whole wave of new efforts pop up across different platforms and different niche categories that have been trying to sort of angle for funding. You've seen a lot of new groups just in the past year and a half grow really rapidly, both creators and brands online.
Where do you think Democrats on the campaign sort of elected side have genuinely improved online since 2024, and where are they still stuck?
Yeah, for sure. I think something that I notice a lot that Democrats really deserve a lot of credit for are these like Capitol Hill communications directors and press secretaries. They have a really tough job nowadays. You know, they used to just be able to pitch a couple reporters on Capitol Hill or CNN bookers, whatever. Now they have to like do hardcore research to find out what niche audience they're trying to reach, who are the people that speak to them, what podcasts they're listening to, what random YouTube interview shows should they go on. And they're succeeding wildly. You know, last summer I interviewed Sarah Drury, who's the communications director for Congressman Ro Khanna. And I think at the time, like, I think last year they went on over like 60 or 70 podcasts, which was like, you know, more than one a week. Everything from Theo Von to probably your guys' shows several times. And so these staffers that are working really hard for Democratic elected officials are making connections and really pitching out their bosses to reach a whole bunch of different audiences. And quite frankly, it's not happening on the right. Like, you're not seeing like Senator Marsha Blackburn from Tennessee like go on Theo Von, but you are seeing Democrats do it, which is really interesting, and it has a lot of implications for both the midterms, as you know, particularly in some of these larger states, and then the 2028 primary. Like I mentioned earlier, it's just going to be wild.
I hadn't thought about that from a communications staffer perspective. What a nightmare it must be to figure out what everyone is listening to or watching and how to put their bosses in front of those audiences. Because there's not like one central repository of information that you can go to. I imagine that's one thing that like AI might make easier for some of these staffers, but That's a big job. That's a big job.
Yeah, it's a lot of research. And maybe they're, you know, they're, that's what a lot of these sort of entry-level press assistants are doing. But I think what Rokana's team told me about how they decide what podcast to go on is they just like sit around in sort of like a writer's room and figure out, oh, you know, I was watching this YouTube show the other day. I think Ro would be really good for this, whatever. Mm. It also depends on what constituency they're trying to reach, right? Like if they are trying to reach older voters in their district, then of course, like, broadcast local news still makes a ton of sense. But if maybe they have more national ambitions, then I think going on, you know, the Adam Friedland show or something could be beneficial.
You mentioned the Democratic donor class. You wrote last fall that you've lost count of how many donor advisors, staffers, media, entrepreneurs have mentioned Turning Point as something the left needs to replicate. Your own data shows Turning Point USA was one of the fastest growing political YouTube channels of early 2026. Two questions. What would a TPUSA of the left look like? And why do you think the people writing the checks haven't been able to bring it into existence yet?
You know, that's a really tough question that I definitely don't have all the answers for. But, you know, I think what's really important for a lot of these growing liberal media efforts is thinking first about like what audiences they're actually reaching. There's been a ton of growth, particularly on YouTube, among people that I would maybe like call in a somewhat derogatory fashion, like blue MAGA influencers, people that just like scream into the camera about how bad Donald Trump is. But those people's audience is overwhelmingly sort of old, wealthy white people, people like my in-laws, that are just really addicted to the news and really upset by everything that Donald Trump is doing. And so there's a lot fewer efforts that are reaching young people and some of the same people that Turning Point USA is reaching. That's a major challenge. Like, the content, the formats, and the platforms that are needed to reach young college-age kids or younger is very different from the platforms that you and I consume and the content that we consume online. And so, yeah, there's currently not a lot we can do about it. I think there's several efforts that are trying to sort of experiment and grow and reach younger people. But it's going to take like a lot of different strategies, tactics, and groups to do so.
Do you think this donor class suddenly like discovered TPUSA and how effective it is because of Charlie Kirk's assassination? Do you think that's what did it? Or like why do you think so many people are bringing TPUSA specifically up to you?
Yeah, I mean, they just, you know, they became a massive grassroots juggernaut on the right, seemingly overnight. Now, I have charts that also show how much money they've raised since like 2012 or whenever they were founded back in the Obama era. And they've slowly been able to amass now what is around like $90, $95, $100 million in revenue each year. Year over year, they continue to grow. And I do think like the Kirk assassination and its cultural resonance with people of all stripes, particularly young conservatives, was a wake-up call for people that this is a huge juggernaut. They're tied very closely to the Trump political operation. In 2024, the Trump campaign basically outsourced their on-the-ground field organizing to Turning Point USA, their voter registration efforts. And so I think liberals see something very big and scary on the right and are like, great, we have to replicate this. We have to do something about this. And so I think folks are going to try. It's unclear if Turning Point is going to have real staying power on the right. They're incredibly disorganized. Of course, they're very good at the podcast space. They have a huge presence on YouTube. They have, you know, real organic engagement on their, you know, chapters on campuses around the country. But will it be able to like continue growing under new leadership? It's unclear to me. I think a lot of what they're doing right now is recycling old content from Charlie Kirk and trying to recreate the magic that he brought to the organization.
Yeah, and it does seem like to the extent that they are different than other organizations, both on the left and right, and to the extent there is some kind of magic about it, it is the on the ground, real life organizing effort that I think you don't see with a lot of other media organizations on either side. But it feels like that is maybe one of the most important things to do, is to sort of blend the online and offline media organizing strategies together if you actually want to win elections. So to your earlier point about a lot of the liberal media enterprises sort of reaching older voters, high engagement older voters, at a higher volume? Who do you see that's actually reaching some of the lower engagement, younger voters on the left?
I think any of these efforts that are focusing a lot on TikTok, you know, journalists, particularly here in DC, wrote incessantly about TikTok's impact on our politics back in 2024. And it seems like no one's like checked in on that ever since. But it's still a place where young people get so much news, information, cultural trends are born. And so there are a bunch of efforts, probably too many to name, that are focused on reaching young people on platforms like TikTok, to some extent, Instagram as well. I think on YouTube, like More Perfect Union, which is, an outlet that does investigative short form documentaries about issues impacting working people, is doing a really good job. And they've explicitly kind of expanded into trying to reach younger audiences. But there's no single force that is like doing like a huge job of organizing young people. Back when I was coming up in politics, speaking of California gubernatorial race, Tom Steyer, founded and ran Next Gen America, and it was like a huge organizing force. And he stepped away from that organization to pursue his own, political goals. And I think Democrats since then have really taken the youth vote and young people for granted, just thought that they were always going to vote for Democrats. And 2024 really kind of was a wake up call.
It is a hard thing to do. And I can say this speaking as a co-founder of one of these media companies, that it is an easy thing to say, oh, we want to reach young people. In this media and information environment, I find that one of the big challenges is younger people, younger audiences are gravitating towards individual creators and more so than like larger media companies. And I mean, our audiences, I think, is younger than some of our other counterparts. Like, I know you've written that like Midas Touch, which is huge. Also, it's like their audience does skew older, which, might be surprising. It was surprising to me when I learned. But it's, if you have an information ecosystem where the younger creators that reach the younger audiences are all on their own, and why would they sort of join up with a big media company or a bigger media company? Then it becomes trickier as the media company to like find those audiences.
Yeah, for sure. The incentives are all messed up. And also for sort of the liberal media companies, your incentives are, you want to grow as fast as possible. You want high engagement. You want to monetize that audience. And I think older audiences that are hyper engaged in politics and news are much easier to monetize. They're the folks that are going to subscribe $10 a month to a Substack or, binge. If you're retired, they're going to be binging, political content on YouTube. And so that's low hanging fruit. And that's why we've seen liberal media outlets over the past year grow so quickly. But you're right. I mean, a lot of content reaching younger audiences, particularly on YouTube, is really personality driven. Me and my husband watch like Mr. Beast all the time, which is insane. And if you think about like what he's pushing, he's like selling a candy bar company. That tells you how young his audience is. It's like he's pushing Feastables in every one of his videos. So like he's trying to reach children. So I think there's a lot we can take, particularly from some of these non-political efforts in the YouTube space, that would be really, really fun to try and replicate online with more sort of overtly political projects.
Offline is brought to you by Hims. If you want to know what's really worth your time and energy when it comes to losing weight, skip the guesswork and get weight loss by Hims. Hims offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications that now includes the Wegovy pill at its lowest price ever and the Wegovy pen, plus lifestyle tips to support you along the way. Through Hims, everything happens online. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door. No insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Hims makes hitting your goals seamless by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and in-app lifestyle and nutrition support like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. With a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hims makes it simple to find a weight loss approach that fits into your world and your wallet if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. Ready to reach your goals? Visit hims.com/offline to get a personalized, affordable plan that gets you. That's hims.com/offline, hims.com/offline. Based on advertised cash price for 30-day supply of medication only, membership required, fee not included, and billed separately, weight loss by Hims is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit hims.com. I do want to zero in on YouTube because it's arguably the most political, the most important political platform in America, but probably less discussed than your TikToks or your X's, at least on the media. Your April data on the 100 biggest political channels has 64 that lean right, 36 that lean left, and the right's cumulative subscriber base is around 250 million versus about 150 million for the left. When it comes to politics, is YouTube more of a right-wing platform, or is that gap closing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, conservatives have dominated YouTube and the podcast space, quite frankly, for many years. And it's just a place that, you know, you think about conservative personalities that are really primed for TV news, or maybe they spun off from TV news, people like Tucker Carlson, Megyn Kelly, all of the Daily Wire's cast of characters, whether it's Matt Walsh or formerly Candace Owens, Ben Shapiro. These people are yelling into the camera, trying to sell outrage bait, and YouTube is a really good platform to algorithmically spread that type of content. And so over the past 10 years, you've just seen these creators accumulate millions and millions of followers with like this very easy to replicate format. I think the dynamics of the platform are still similar. Some of those right-wing creators, YouTubers, are starting to plateau and kind of hit a ceiling. While, like I mentioned earlier, there are some young sort of pro-dem creators that are really surging and growing on the platform. It's really interesting to kind of see like who is up and who is down at a particular moment, particularly on the right. You hear so much about the influence of Ben Shapiro, and there's already been a lot of reporting about this recently, but Homeboy has lost like 120,000 YouTube subscribers since the beginning of the year, wow, which is more than a lot of these political channels even have. And the other channels owned by the Daily Wire, his media company, have also lost tens of thousands of subscribers. Meanwhile, people like Tucker Carlson, who are even more to the fringe on the right and, you know, are making a lot of enemies in some MAGA circles, are surging. Candace Owens spreading conspiracies about Charlie Kirk's death, also growing really rapidly. And you have some of these up-and-comers like Nick Shirley, who does kind of faux investigative journalism, also growing. So the old kingmakers are kind of going away and new ones are rising all the time. And YouTube is just really unique in the fact that people are growing really, really quickly, constantly. And that's why I put out some of these reports every quarter.
What do you make of that, that Shapiro and the Daily Wire are losing audience to the Tuckers, to the Candaces? As you said, there's sort of a rage bait element to this where you're yelling at a camera. But, you know, I'd say that Tucker is pretty fringy, and so is, you know, Nick Fuentes and these characters. But a lot of what they're doing is kind of like long form conspiracy theory. They're not always doing the like blaring headlines, but they are like captivating a lot of the right's attention for a long period of time.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think something that their audience really demands across these right-wing influencers is, it's kind of like a seeming like independence and contrarianism. Mm. And so Tucker is really good at like finding ways that he can break with sort of the MAGA crowd, seem very independent. People will like flock to that. Whereas Ben Shapiro has been a little bit more of a cheerleader for traditional right-wing views, particularly on Israel at a time when, you know, Israel is increasingly unpopular with grassroots in both parties. And I wouldn't attribute his fall entirely to the Israel issue, but I do think it's illustrative of like, you know, him unwilling to kind of cater to the changing demands of the America First movement. Also, his content is just a little stale. He's been doing it for so long that it's not really bringing a lot of new people to the table. And he could have just hit a ceiling, right? If he has, I don't know, it's something like 7 or 8 million YouTube subscribers. Is that the ceiling for this type of format on the platform? Like, there's just not more people that want to listen to that kind of stuff.
Do you see any kind of analogous dynamic on the left in left media, or even like the beginnings of one? And is there sort of a lesson or maybe a warning for liberals and Democrats in this?
It's you, John. It's you guys. No, I think, you know, I do
think... We're going to go straight conspiracy from now on.
Yeah. I do think what's really interesting is all of these investments and this growth in sort of a new liberal media ecosystem, and particularly these individual personalities and creators, is creating a bench of new gatekeepers on the left. Mm. You think about people like... podcasts I really like. I've had it with Jennifer Welch. She has her own political views and opinions that when a candidate, particularly a 2028 presidential candidate, potentially goes on her show, they're going to want to cater to what they already know and research that she believes and say the right things for her. That goes for all of these different folks. You know, some candidates are going to want to go on your show and some are going to be a little bit more scared, maybe based on your past opinions. And so that new bench of gatekeepers is going to really, I hope that a lot of these folks understand the influence that they have on both their audience and on the candidates in the party and even the party's platform moving forward. Because you see what happens when there are these giant juggernauts like Candace Owens and Ben Shapiro and Tucker Carlson, Steve Bannon, all feuding against each other. It's creating like serious divisions and creates entire new cycles of drama that then become a distraction for their entire side. You've seen it, like little micro dramas have played out. I mentioned the California gubernatorial race. I think the race earlier this year between James Tallarico and Jasmine Crockett got a little nasty with some mid-tier influencers feuding and accusing each other of things online. And you know, as these creators on the left continue to grow, I expect to see a whole lot more of that.
Quick one, because this surprised me. You found Fox News is now big on TikTok, of all places.
I know.
And then also, since the Iran war started, you found major mainstream news brands growing on TikTok faster than they have in years. What do you think's going on there?
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, you think about when a lot of people think about TikTok, they think about individual creators doing, you know, cultural trends, whatnot, or even individual news creators explaining, you know, the news of the day direct to camera to their audiences. But in recent months, it seems like the platform and its algorithm have really prioritized legacy news brands that are verified, spreading news clips to their audiences, growing really, really quickly. This British tabloid, the Daily Mail, has always been one of the biggest news brands on the platform, which was really striking to a lot of people. But over the past year, Fox News in particular, they really didn't have a major presence on the platform during the 2024 election. And they somewhat like tripled their posting cadence. TikTok is a major volume gain. And these legacy news brands have a lot of video clips that they're able to post and share. And so they have grown super rapidly, outpacing a lot of their other sort of more mainstream counterparts, as have really any of these outlets, whether it's Al Jazeera, BBC, posting content about the war. Some could say it's kind of a good thing that users are being fed more like authoritative information about the news of the day. Obviously, the increase in conservative content on the platform, in my view, not a great thing. You know, the platform changed ownership in January, and I've been really monitoring it closely to see how politics on TikTok has shifted in these past few months. And I'll probably write something about it in the coming weeks. But it's something to keep an eye on. I mean, like I said earlier, it's a place where people, you know, millions of Americans continue to get their news and information, and folks need to pay attention to it.
It's interesting that it is a... it seems like the key there is that it's a volume game. And if you are a big enough media organization, and this is probably a lesson for folks on the left who have this capacity, like your MS Nows and places like that, and you just pump out more clips on TikTok, you're going to grow your audience.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, during the 2024 election, I was leading the national team at Courier, which is a progressive newsroom.
Oh, yeah. Huge.
We really focused on TikTok as a strategy. My team, I think in the final, you know, a couple of weeks of the election, we were posting something like 300, 400 videos a week on TikTok, original pieces of content, both news aggregation and original content. And that volume gain is really, really important to kind of feed the beast of that algorithm. And as a result, we grew, you know, zero to several million really rapidly.
The topic I really wanted to get into that we've mentioned a few times now is, are these sort of paid influencer world now. Both parties are now spending like millions per cycle paying these influencers. Most of it is invisible to people who are watching. Walk all of us through this world like we know nothing. How does a campaign actually engage creators? Who's paid? Who's unpaid? Who's brokering these deals? Like, how does it all work?
So there's a couple ways that a political campaign might work with creators. The first is really straightforward. You know, comms team reaches out to a major social media influencer whose audience they want to reach, and they just want to partner and have a conversation with them. Maybe they'll connect the candidate directly with them. Friendly, you know, basic surrogacy, no money exchanged. And that's really common. You know, folks just want to support campaigns, like-minded, whatever. Increasingly, though, creator marketing is being seen as a paid media technique for these campaigns. And while it has been doing that, you know, since the 2020 election, at least on the presidential level, it's really moved down ballot this year. So campaigns will either pay creators directly to post content. Maybe they will pay them per post. They could, you know, in some cases I've seen they're paying $10,000 a post to post something favorable about a candidate. They may have them on retainer. So one campaign in California claimed that they were not paying an influencer to post, but they gave him $400,000 to be just a digital strategist, which had nothing to do with the size of his audience, I'm sure, the post that he was making. And then another way that campaigns do this is that they work with an intermediary creator marketing firm. So there's a half dozen creator marketing firms on the left. There's a half dozen creator marketing firms on the right, and everyone from a presidential campaign to an organization like Planned Parenthood or something, an advocacy group, will pay these firms to run short-term creator marketing campaigns. And what those firms do is they go out and find social media influencers across platforms, large and small, different interest groups, different audiences, and they'll send them a creative brief. They'll say, we want you to talk about abortion rights in California and why it's really important to pay attention to that issue this fall. And then those creators will receive a set amount of money. Maybe they'll be paid on a conversion basis. Maybe they'll be paid for how many views they get on their content. Maybe they'll just be paid a flat fee per post. And they go do that. Now, you would think some of these creators will disclose in the comments, like, this is a paid partnership with X campaign. But the vast majority of the time, these paid relationships go undisclosed. And so no one in the audience understands, like, who is paying for this message? Is this something that the influencer really believes or not? It's becoming a huge issue. Every week, it seems like there's new reporting and investigations happening about this money changing hands. And like I said, you know, one candidate in California recently spent millions of dollars on this.
Is this the Steyer campaign?
The Steyer campaign, yeah, for sure. I think they paid one influencer $400,000. They were paying random people that weren't even in California just $10 to create a video of them backing Steyer online, I guess, to create some sort of organic engagement and some, yeah, it's wild. And I joke a lot to reporters and folks here in DC that, like, come 2028, some of these campaigns that are running for president are just going to be handing YouTubers like bags of cash. There's not a lot we can do about it. This week, I interviewed a member of Congress, Mark Tucano from Riverside, California, who watched all of this play out in the California gubernatorial race and was really upset about it and thought it was disingenuous that this undisclosed stuff is happening. And he wants to start a conversation on Capitol Hill. He introduced a bill to require FEC disclosures and these types of things like you see in political TV advertising. But it's got a long way to go. He's got a lot of work to do on education. And of course, there's going to be tons of different loopholes that need to be addressed.
So how did the Steyer paid influence campaign end up coming to light? Like, was it the FEC? I mean, because there's no disclosure requirements whatsoever. Like, was it their campaign finance reports?
It was campaign finance filings. So people, you know, notice X amount of money being paid to a certain LLC or a certain creator's name. And then they sort of went back and found out, like, oh, they're spending this much money on creator marketing. I think they paid a couple of creator marketing firms to run their campaigns too. And so you can definitely, like, find out about this on the campaign finance side. But in some cases, creators will have their own one sort of Delaware-based anonymous LLC that they will use. So it's just like paying any other consultant. It's really opaque. I think California does have some modest disclosure laws, and some folks were accusing the Steyer campaign of violating those laws. But generally, most states do not have any sort of regulation of this.
And we should say that it wasn't just, I think Steyer's campaign sort of got the bulk of the attention on this. I think Becerra had some issues too, and it's happening sort of all over the place.
For sure.
I watched your interview, or I read your interview with Congressman Takano, and he said something about the legislation he introduced that sort of stuck with me, which is the bill tries to draw a line between a creator who's a genuine paid advisor and one who's become, as in his word, was a mouthpiece. That seems tricky to do. Yeah. And I don't know that is the fact that a creator becomes a paid advisor for the campaign like better in a way than a creator who's just posting as a mouthpiece? Like, I'm not quite sure I know what the difference between being a paid advisor and a mouthpiece is.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, what they're trying to avoid there is like a campaign hires a communications director who just happens to have like 100,000 followers on Twitter or something. And as long as the vast majority of the work that they do for the campaign is not posting on their personal socials, then they would be exempted from the disclosure. But I think the reason why they wrote it is the one example from the Steyer campaign where, you know, they presumably paid a creator $400,000 to be a mouthpiece for the campaign. And that creator said that it was just for advising.
Offline is brought to you by Green Chef. Sometimes, you know, you read about these diets or these health fads and you're like, all right, I'm going to try this. And you try to, you know, whether it's like no carbs or it's pescatarian or whatever it may be, you know, it's sort of hard to stick with some of these things. But where fad diets fail, Green Chef delivers real food and recipes that make healthy eating an easy and sustainable part of your routine. With Green Chef, every week you get over 40 recipes made with organic produce, responsibly sourced proteins, and nothing you can't pronounce. Pick what matters to you, Mediterranean, high protein, or their new longevity line built around brain and gut health. Meals come pre-portioned and ready in minutes. And if you want guidance beyond the plate, they include free, unlimited one-on-one nutrition coaching that helps you stay on track. Green Chef is the only certified clean meal kit tested by the Clean Label Project and the most sustainable meal kit with 20% less food waste and 100% offset delivery admissions. So our assistant Naomi received her first Green Chef order. She chose the chicken and leek pasta, the chicken salad. She really enjoyed that. Prepping the meal, she said, was super easy. The instructions were clear, easy to follow. And she didn't have to measure anything. She liked that. All the ingredients came packaged in their own serving package, made it really easy to put it all together in no time. Head to greenchef.com/50offline and use code 50offline to get 50% off your first month, then 20% off for 2 months. That's code 50offline at greenchef.com/50offline. Practical advice for listeners, because probably everyone listening consumes this content. Like, how can you tell when you're watching paid content? Are there tells? Like, does paid content even look different from true believer content? What do you think?
Here's my thing is like, I don't really buy that like pay to post political creator messaging is like very effective whatsoever, right?
Okay.
Like if you give Jon Favreau a long list of talking points for you to say on an issue, and you just kind of read those out in order to get your $10 for your user generated content or whatever it is. That's not as convincing as you actually believing in the issue and you want to tell your audience about it because you think it's so important. And so a much more authentic way of engaging these people with very large audiences and reaching their audiences, I think, would be beneficial to all of these campaigns.
Yeah. One thing the whole thing does is it increases people's cynicism of you when you're not being paid, but you really do have a genuine belief about a candidate or a cause that you say. Like, people now just assume that you're getting paid by the campaign. And, you know, it's tough to blame them if this is sort of, if this whole like creator, paid creator economy is out there and without any kind of disclosure or regulation. But I do think that it is overall, whether it's effective or not, whether the actual, you know, paying for it is more effective politically, I do think it sort of damages the overall sort of political ecosystem, because it just increases cynicism and distrust in the process, which is already sky high.
Absolutely. And also, like, there's this thing online where, like, you know, people on Twitter, particularly from the left, will be like, are you paid by the DNC to do this? And I'm like, girl, the DNC does not have the money to pay these people. So no. But yeah, it's like there's already a lot of people that are very distrustful, particularly, you know, I saw this a lot, like during the early Biden presidential reelect, people were like, you're not genuinely excited about Joe Biden. Why are you posting favorable content about this? And, you know, last fall during the off year elections, there was a lot of content favorable to Abigail Spanberger and Mikey Sherrill. And some of it was like, get ready with me while I go vote for Mikey Sherrill because XYZ. I'm like, nah, this is 100% paid.
Yeah. How does the Republican paid influencer ecosystem differ from the Democratic one? I would guess it's older, maybe better funded, more comfortable with non-disclosure, but maybe not. I don't know. You probably have actual data.
A lot of it revolves around Twitter. So X, particularly because Trump is in power, there are a ton of corporations and lobbying groups that are paying far-right influencers like Laura Loomer and others to, you know, post content about their pet issue. So like one day you will see Laura Loomer and a bunch of others talking about why some random legislation is important to the government of India. And you're like, that is 100% paid. And people have slowly been publishing investigations and receipts of this. I think in one instance, I saw a bunch of right-wing influencers were paid $50 just to hit the retweet button on a post. Others were being paid $1,000 just to copy and paste certain posts. And this is all in hopes of getting in front of Republican elected officials who are all addicted to using the app personally, and they know that they can get their stuff in front of the big guy in the White House as well. So I think X is just like a really, really important platform for them. And, you know, they really aren't as much on platforms like TikTok. There are a lot of corporations, particularly like the crypto industry, the AI industry, the prediction markets, that are spending a lot of money on this type of stuff, particularly because Trump is in the White House.
Lovely, lovely.
Yeah, that's great.
I want to ask about Substack. You wrote a piece on this and argued that the biggest political voices on Substack skew progressive. How much do you think of a counterweight Substack is to the right's apparatus? Newsletter readers are the most engaged, most educated slice of the electorate. Do you think that is influence? Is that now all the Substack people are in a bubble and talking to the same people? Like, how do you think about that?
Yeah, I very much view Substack similar to Blue Sky in the sense that it's like, it's very liberal. Vast majority of particularly political and news publications are left-leaning. And a lot of the folks that have succeeded there are mostly opinion-based anti-MAGA, anti-Trump voices. You think of people like Don Lemon or Jim Acosta, Heather Cox Richardson. A lot of these folks are speaking to the same kind of older crowd, I think, of college-educated people that are just looking for content to consume. And like I said, it's really monetizable. So it is kind of its own echo chamber. I think it's a really powerful tool. I appreciate the platform. I've used it before. I'm currently on a competitive platform called Beehive. But it kind of came into, you know, came of age at the same time that a lot of people were leaving X because of Elon Musk's takeover. And so that's where a lot of people went in addition to like Threads and Blue Sky. I do think it's really impactful, particularly I've seen a lot of Democratic candidates starting to join it. It's a good way to connect directly with your audience in their email inbox. I'm sure it could help with fundraising, Q&As, the Substack Live stuff is really important. But I do think that there is a major issue with the fact that so many Democrats and left-leaning voices left X because of Elon Musk's thing, while mainstream political journalists remain on the platform and are just scrolling, looking for stories. And it's like quietly skewing their perception of our politics and how political narratives are spread. So
people have been saying that, you know, X is dying and has become, you know, a fucking wasteland since even before Elon took over, but especially. I do think in the last, like, it has gotten really bad now.
Yeah.
Just in terms of the content you speak, I think because so many people have left, it really is like the most right-leaning platform around. Like, you're just not getting any, you get journalists, you get sort of like Democratic strategists and electeds, and then you've just got right wing is the rest of it.
Oh, and it's all so negative. I mean, you log on, it's like going to war. It's like, wow, why? I didn't even plan on like yelling at random strangers today, but here I am like furiously typing. Like, I can't help it.
Yeah,
it's really bad. You know, I've done some research into what accounts are getting, what political accounts are getting the most views on the platform. I think I published something like a year ago or so. And surprise, surprise, like Elon Musk's account is like the biggest most viewed account on the entire platform. And it's because there are multiple reports alleging that he's instructed, X's engineers to serve all of his content to everyone all the time. And he's more likely to engage with some of these right-leaning influencers, which then boost their content. And so it's overwhelmingly a conservative platform, at least in the content that's fed to the vast majority of users in the political space. And it's real shame. It's super powerful. I think we don't talk enough about the influence of the platform. And like I said, like, it's a place where news cycles that, you know, disseminate through CNN and Politico, New York Times, whatever, and become a larger issue kind of start and bubble up.
Yeah, that is the central sort of paradox or tension with X, which is, it is garbage. It is very right wing, but it still and it does have a small user base, smaller than most of the other platforms. But that doesn't mean that the influence has decreased all that much, because so many journalists are still on the platform, and whether they like to admit it or not, you know, even subconsciously, the content that they're getting there and what they're reading there is seeping into coverage. It is seeping into decisions that political campaigns make and Democratic politicians. Like, it is tough to get around.
Absolutely. Yep.
Let's talk 2028. I won't ask you to make any predictions, but maybe we can sort of grade the digital strategies of the potential 2028 candidates. You've written about Josh Shapiro as the influencer governor, about Gavin Newsom having a very good year online, about Ro Khanna flooding the zone. Like, who do you think actually understands this environment? Who doesn't seem to get it yet? Who's sort of missing altogether?
I very much view the 2028 Democratic primary for president is like well underway, and it has been for many months. And so seeing what types of media appearances that these folks are doing, what types of influencers they're doing content with is going to be really illustrative of how they're going to run a campaign a year from now. I talked a lot about Josh Shapiro. His team, you know, he has a team of folks that work explicitly on influencer engagement and do all sorts of less conventional, I would say, sort of collaborations and content work. Sports creators, like golf podcasters, he's a big sports guy. And so he's talking both in state and out of state with people that are very non-political. Whereas, you know, Gavin Newsom is doing all, like, playing all the hits. He's hitting all the big political creators because ever since, I mean, you know, the early 2000s, like, blogger era, he's been building relationships with these types of new media voices. I think one of the most interesting things I saw last year was that, like, the lack of sort of podcasts and major influencer collabs from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She really, like, kept a low profile last year while others were flooding the zone. I mentioned Ro Khanna doing like 60 or 70 podcasts. And now she's just started to, it seems like in the past month or two, start to do a little bit of unexpected content plays and collaborations and interviews with different folks. Just this week, I saw a video of her from More Perfect Union, video startup on YouTube, going down to Georgia, meeting with residents upset about data centers. And to me, that read immediately like a 2028, you know, content play, testing the waters, both in the South and on an issue that's going to matter a lot to voters. So yeah, people are angling, you know, some people are running ads, like Pete Buttigieg is out there grassroots fundraising online all the time. It'll be really interesting to see, like, you know, how they staff up, how they think about online creator engagement, what podcasts they're willing to go on, which ones are they like dead scared of going on. I feel very bad for Rahm Emanuel's communications team because, you know, he's getting hounded on all of these podcasts. So yeah, it's going to be fun to watch.
Yeah, I would say we had Tommy interviewed Rahm the day before I interviewed Hassan Piker. They both came into the office themselves. And let me tell you, the reactions to both interviews, pretty bad in different directions. But I will say that the comments on Rahm's were not much better than Hassan's.
I
do think the Shapiro thing is interesting, because I would have said Shapiro's X presence is like your typical cut and paste press office statement. He doesn't seem like he's anywhere, but also I am a just political junkie and all I consume is political news. Whereas, like you said, Gavin is trying to be like the king of the highly engaged political junkies who are online all the time. The like resistance libs or Blue MAGA or whatever you want to call it. And it does strike me that if you're going to try to reach beyond just Democratic primary voters and the highly engaged, you probably do want to have a strategy that gets you outside the political bubble.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the point of this new media environment is that there's 1,000 different ways that 1,000 different groups of people are consuming 1,000 different formats and types of information. And so, I think a good digital strategy in this age is stuff that like you and I will never see or hear about. It's like little appearances on niche podcasts, collaborations with different influencers in different states that, yeah, is meant to reach different types of people.
You mentioned AOC's trip to Georgia on data centers. You've called data centers maybe the defining issue of the election. I know you've done some actual reporting on this where you've gone yourself to West Virginia. Talk about why you think it's such a defining issue and what you found. And what struck me about it is it one of these issues where sort of the mainstream press or the legacy media is talking about it a little, but if you sat in a focus group or you actually went and talked to some people on the ground in different states, they would be talking about it a lot more than you hear about it in the news, almost like analogous maybe on the right to like the Epstein files back in 2024.
I'm so into this issue. I'm like blackpilled. It's like all I think about. I think there's just, it's such a fascinating issue for so many different reasons. One, you know, people don't want these like hulking monstrosities in their backyards, particularly where a lot of these things are being built is in like wilderness areas near like pastoral, beautiful farmland. And people move to be like, people live in like farm country because they want to live next to farms and not giant, like, you know, cement warehouses. And so that issue is just like cutting across both Republican and Democratic constituencies in a way that I haven't seen a lot of issues do so. In DC, so many people that are focused on it are like, oh, it's about, you know, energy costs going up in water. Once we address those, it's going to be okay. But it's actually like people just don't want to live next to these giant things that like give off heat. And, you know, it's just like, it's insane. So I think, you know, what I'm really worried about is Democrats in DC listening to sort of some of these policy think tanks and not really thinking about like just trying to make the issue work and not really thinking about how visceral the reaction is in many communities to these things just coming in and bulldozing thousands of acres of land. The place I went to in West Virginia over Memorial Day weekend, small county, I mean, you couldn't go 50 yards in the entire county without seeing a yard sign planted that said no data center in Tucker County.
Wow.
And what happened with that one is the state legislature, you know, passed a law in 2025 banning localities from doing any regulation of data centers. And this, the mayors of the towns in this county found out about the data center coming through like an ad in the newspaper. No local input. It just touches on so many different flashpoints in our politics. And I really do think, you know, some free advice for Democrats is that potential presidential candidate J.D. Vance is very tied to this industry and the people behind it. And so, like, if I were giving them advice, I would say to lean in pretty hard.
Do you see it getting a lot of traction online in a lot of these platforms and different online communities?
Yeah, that's one thing I didn't mention. Once I started consuming anti-data center content, it's like all the algorithms would feed me with every other post was anti-data center content. And it was the most stunning breadth and depth. I saw like country singers posting about data centers Wow. in Utah. I saw environmental folks in Kentucky, some folks in Appalachia, local news in Mississippi, Nebraska. You know, this week that I was digging really deep into all of this type of content was just surfacing a really diverse array of small, like, not paid creators, people with 5,000 followers on Instagram or whatever, talking about what was happening in their communities and urging people to go to county meetings and protest. Yeah, it's one of the fastest growing issues that I've seen in the political space online. I saw, you know, Google search interest in data centers is way up, historic highs, particularly over the past 6 months. And posts about it from all sorts of different political accounts are peaking right now. So it's something that, you know, politicians aren't going to be able to not pay attention to.
I do think it's a fascinating contrast, what you just mentioned, which is we talked earlier about this sort of paid creator influencer economy, campaign spending all this money so to get creators to like mount their talking points. And is it even effective because it just seems so inorganic? And then you've got this issue bubbling up that cuts across party lines where there's such genuine, authentic anger around it that Democrats and Republicans too just could be sort of missing out on maybe one of the most important issues to most people in the country, or to at least a lot of people in the country.
Absolutely. I mean, I saw like posts from like right-wing chambers of commerce and rural counties opposing these things. I mean, it's really across the partisan divide, and it's going to be really interesting to see like how folks adapt to it, particularly in the midterms. Like it's right in front of us.
Kyle Tharp, thank you so much for joining. This was really fun. Everyone go subscribe to The Chaotic Era. It's a fantastic newsletter, and thanks for all you're doing.
Thanks for having me.
Take care. Offline is a Crooked Media production. It's written and hosted by me, Jon Favreau. It's produced by Emma Illich Frank. Austin Fisher is our senior producer, and Anisha Banerjee is our associate producer. Audio support from Charlotte Landis. Adrian Hill is our head of news and politics. Matt DeGroat is our VP of production. Jordan Katz and Kenny Siegel take care of our music. Thanks to Delon Villanueva, Eric Shute, and our digital team who film and share our episodes as videos every week. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.